Jane Morris, editor-at-large of the art newspaper, casts her astute eye over some of the more artistic organs on the newsstand, and we'll check out a new publication designed to get your creative juices flowing. That's all to come, right here on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. At the top of the show this week, a word on last Thursday's van attack in Barcelona. Once again, the press was compelled to try and make sense of yet another deadly act of terrorism with probity and insight. Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé joins me now to look at how some of the Spanish dailies handled this tall task. Tyler, it's interesting. I just wonder, what was your reaction when you saw some of the Spanish language and Spanish front pages the morning after the Barcelona attack? Because the images are certainly pretty arresting, if nothing else.
I mean, there's actually two things, and before we get to that, two components in the world of media today. I came back on Friday morning from Hong Kong, and this is just a little, the way the world works today, Tom, it was quite fascinating. So I got on my plane out of Hong Kong Thursday evening, very, very late, I mean, just around midnight, coming to London. And what was interesting, so I was on an aircraft without Wi-Fi, I didn't know what happened. And the first point of really information was coming through Heathrow and seeing posters already on Friday morning from the Home Office, which said, Barcelona attack. And I thought, it was curious that it didn't reach you in a digital way. It reached you on just some pieces of A4 and A3. Went home and, of course, was watching the coverage and obviously looking at it online when I was in the taxi. And I could sense already that there was a series of reviews watching the various networks where they were looking at the front pages of the major Spanish and Catalan dailies. And that's when I fired a note to you and I said, I think there is something in this in terms of what we've seen out of Germany, how we've seen the French approach this, obviously the press in this country and also on the other side of the Atlantic, and then the nature of really what happens around the editor's desk, the photo editor's desk in the newsrooms of the major Spanish dailies. And we're sitting here with a number of front covers, and it's quite extraordinary. We have images that you simply, some of the same images we've seen in papers elsewhere, but we're now very used to the ghosted out, the smudged images that you see, obviously, to protect identities and out of just decency and respect. But in the case of, we're looking at El País right now, the front cover, and it's a really graphic image. It's something that I don't think we would see in the English language press. It might live in a digital environment in social media, but it probably wouldn't pass in a morning story meeting.
Well, let me ask you that. As with your journalist hat on, what's driving that? Is it that the newspapers and those put upon picture desk editors that you described there are cognizant of the fact that they need to match up? They only get one shot on their front page to get that moment of impact. Or is it more of an editorial judgment, which is, look, we can't pixelate out, and nor should we. We have to confront the public with the horrifying reality so they truly can engage with the sorts of depravity that these people are prosecuting. Is it one of those? Is it both of those?
It could be both. I think on one side, you know, we have seen in some countries, certainly in rolling, in video anyway, in electronic media, that sometimes there is a more graphic approach. And whether that's a more graphic approach to gruesome images or also a graphic approach when it comes to sexual images as well, that there is a certain sort of liberalism at times. I think that there are two things. You know, maybe we are in a moment where the photo desk, when we're talking about print images, when you're having to fight against all, you know, obviously a variety of different electronic channels, and also some not within your own borders. That's the very interesting thing. Of course, you have the likes of these big Spanish players fighting against each other, but also you have people going to CNN Espanol. They're going to other channels as well. So as you said, I think part of it is also stealing a bit of march on the competition. And of course, wanting to underline that we are the newspaper of record within our respective market.
Tyler, just in a word or two, is it too far? I mean, what's too much, though? I mean, these images would have been put on those front pages surely prior to certain next of kin being notified, that kind of thing. I mean, that must remain a consideration despite those other constraints and pressures.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we're looking at La Vanguardia, we're looking at El País and the cover of El Mundo, and all of them are running, you know, with different crops, the exact same image, and it's one which was taken by the Spanish newswire service. out of decency, if it was our call, it was the front cover of our newspaper, I would be looking to still block these images. As you know, and they're horrific, and people with, you know, limbs in directions and angles, they simply shouldn't be. But I believe there's still a component of decency which needs to be respected.
Tyler, thanks for your time, as always. Since 1990, art collectors, admirers and makers have relied on the art newspaper as a pole star by which to navigate the often disorientating landscape of the art world. Regular listeners to Monocle 24 will be familiar with the paper's editor-at-large, Jane Morris, who's a regular contributor. But it's been too long since we last had her on this show, and so I'm very happy to welcome her to the Stack this week. Jane Morris, great to have you with us. You're a veteran of the programme, and it's certainly interesting to talk about art in print, and of course the art newspaper, everyone knows it, the news bible of the trade. How would you sort of sum up, if we take a step back and look at the whole of art in print, what's going on? I mean, across the whole of the print business, there's lots of challenges and turbulence and all this kind of thing. Presumably art publishing not immune from some of those wider challenges, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a pretty challenging environment for everybody at the moment. I think what's been interesting in the art world is that given the enormous kind of boom in prices that's happened from the early 2000s onwards, obviously checked in the recession, but not checked as much in the financial crisis, but perhaps not checked as much as people thought it would be. So the enormous amount of money that's come into the art world has meant that there have been a lot of new entrants into the world of art publishing, which used to be, you know, a very niche specialist, I would say, rather gentlemanly in that sort of quite nice old-fashioned sense of the word. And, you know, the art newspaper was one of those publications. Art Forum has been going for a long time. There were a few other magazines like Apollo, and then the newspapers. And, you know, basically it was a very Art in America. You know, it was basically a very sort of small world talking largely to the inside. Mm. And it would be the newspapers that spoke to the outside world. Well, there has been an enormous amount of new entrants into this market. But the reality is it's a difficult market to make work. The specialist audience is still small. It's grown, but it's still small. Although there's a lot of money in the art world, it's really about a relatively small number of galleries selling to a relatively small number of people. So it's not even like luxury clothes, you know, because in luxury clothes you've got, yes, that same very small haute couture market, but the big brands are all trying to flog lots of lipsticks. Mm. There is no equivalent to that in the art world. So I would say the readerships are still relatively small and the advertising is limited. And it's perhaps no surprise that the two Bibles, which I would say for news is the art newspaper, I mean, I would say that, but I think that is true still, although there are much stronger competitors now than there used to be. And equally Art Forum, which again has a lot of competitors but has always been the curator's Bible, that both of those still have robust advertising, and you can see that by looking at them. But as I say, there's more and more and more people trying to get a slice of the cake. People have tried all sorts of things, like trying to appeal to luxury brands, which generally doesn't seem to work, but they try it. People trying to reach new audiences. Plus we have the digital issues like everybody else, which great opportunities but also great challenges.
Indeed. And I just wonder on that point about then editorial tone, I guess it's a little easier maybe if you're talking about the news agenda, which is faster moving. Editorially and tonally, is it about then being, you know, the trade title? Is it that B2B sort of note to things? Or is there a, you know, you presumably and everyone else, everyone's mindful of trying to reach a broader demographic? How do you balance that up? Is that really an important balance to strike?
I think for the news titles, it's easier because we take our cues from what happens, I would say, in the wider world of journalism. So I think at the art newspaper, and I would say some of the other news outlets, that say the competitors like ArtNet and so forth, they're a little bit more tabloidy in style. Mm. But, you know, we would take our cues very much from what the New York Times is doing, what the Financial Times is doing. A lot of our writers tend to write for those publications as well, The Economist. So we're really looking at the mainstream, broadsheet, high-end, I suppose, media. I mean, I would say actually a lot of what we publish is very similar to what Monocle publishes in its approach and style and so forth. It's much more difficult in the review magazines, I would say. Mm. It's always been a problem in the art world, and Art Forum is an example of it, although this issue is quite well written, that there is a market, apparently, for this very specialist curatorial language, which very few people understand. And most art magazines struggle with that. And I think they struggle with trying to impress their own very narrow peer group and also writing versus writing for a more general exhibition going audience. And I think the general exhibition going audience cannot understand a great swathe of the art magazines. I think it's very interesting, though, because, you know, I've been looking at who writes very well. And I found this essay by Francis Morris, the director of Tate Modern, about Giacometti. And it was a brilliant piece of writing, very, very clear, very easy to understand, very engaging. And she's an expert. So I think there is still an issue in the museum and gallery world about learning to talk clearly and with confidence about art in a way that is understandable. And a lot of the art magazines still fall into the trap of writing some really incomprehensible, in some cases, sometimes comprehensible but difficult, other times incomprehensible twaddle.
I like that you say it as it is. And what's also refreshing about that is that there's that old truism that actually good writing is good writing. You should be able to pick that up and read it, even if you come in from a position, as I so often do, Jane, of complete ignorance about these things, and get something out of it. It's not that complicated, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that people get themselves tied up in knots, though, with the idea, for example, many artists are not terribly keen on you identifying where they come from, for example. Now, my view then is you have to say, who's my duty to? And I think it's to your readers. And I think people do find it useful to know that it may not be the most important thing in the artist's career, and it may not have to be the angle of the piece or sentence one.
It's just a piece of context, but it's context nevertheless.
Exactly.
On this broader point about, I'm always interested in sector publishing, how, and you've alluded to the challenges from digital and this sort of thing. I would have thought that in art and arts journalism, there's a broader demographic and simply more people who value traditional media. I mean, is it an issue, do you think, that within the world of art, more people actually still like their print and they'd be happier reading a piece of criticism, for example, on the printed page rather than on a phone or something?
It does seem to be the case, actually. Even the art newspaper, which, again, because it's news-driven, would be and does publish a lot online, but is possibly a more natural place to have online. You know, sales of the print edition have pretty much held up. I mean, that has taken a lot of work to do, but, you know, they've pretty much held up. There's definitely an end of art publishing, which is very much about producing the very beautiful object. I think what we, again, is a common problem, and anyone who's listening who's, you know, studied art history at any time will know this problem. There still seems to be a great problem between getting good writing with lots of good and relevant pictures in the same place. You tend to have the good writing in the publications without any images, and the very beautiful ones look beautiful, but the writing is often
challenging.
Not that great, let's say.
You're such a diplomat, Jane. It's great. Always fun talking to you. Well, let's maybe dive into the stack of magazines you brought with us. So maybe we can reflect on the line, that balance that you're talking about there, and how some of these titles walk it or fail to walk it, as the case may be. What have you got? Maybe talk us through some of the things that we have with us. And you can start with the art newspaper. Why not?
Well, I mean, I have actually brought titles I like. I do sometimes bring us ones that I don't like. Unfortunately, one of the ones that I don't like, I found quite hard to get hold of in this country. So, art newspaper. Well, I mean, I'm not the editor anymore. I'm an editor at large. And the great thing about being an editor at large means that, you know, I don't actually have to do all the hard work anymore of putting this entire thing together. But I think that, you know, I'm looking at the July-August edition. They're all busy working now on the September edition. All of us who write for it have basically filed now.
And is that true, Jane?
I have actually filed. I did file. I did file on time, just.
Good.
By the skin of my teeth. Very end of day, let's put it that way. So I've done a big review for the next paper of Documenta, which is the once every 5 years huge art extravaganza, this time in Kassel in Athens. But I say, you know, I think the art newspaper, it is essentially a trade publication, although for us trade often means collectors. So we have to write for an audience who are interested but probably didn't study art history and are interested in how the whole art world works, but don't necessarily know because they don't work inside it. So I think they're called prosumers, aren't they, these days?
Nice, prosumers. Nice. I like a portmanteau here.
Yeah. So what else have I brought? I thought about a lot about what I actually read. And there are certain things I read pretty religiously. FT Life and Arts, definitely. New York Times, definitely. The Economist, which I also write for. And what I've brought today is The Economist's 1843 magazine, which I don't know if you look at that one. But I mean, I think this is a really, really interesting magazine. It does break to my mind some of the rules on layout and flow, but I think that's a minor issue. The unrules are there to be broken. Hmm. But I think they have a very interesting sort of side take on things. So in this edition, which is the latest one, they've got the cover story is about people microdosing on LSD in Silicon Valley, which is a kind of fascinating and not particularly art world connected piece. But I noticed through the rest of it about how much of it in some way or another relates to my interests in the art world. So basically, one of the articles is about the collaboration between Louis Vuitton and Supreme. But the bit I was interested in that was, well, twofold. One is one of the young people queuing up for these pop-up stores, basically there to flip the clothes they're sat up all night and queued for, referred to themselves as the new art dealers. And I thought that was very interesting because, of course, for a long time, less so now, that is how a lot of art dealers in the boom were making their money, you know, buying and flipping as quickly as they could. Louis Vuitton, of course, are interesting because they also try and engage in the art world and have their own museum and so forth. And then there's another piece a bit later on about a man who tries to collect stardust, literally. I mean, he's a musician in Norway and he lies on shed roofs and sifts this stuff under microscopes. And that really had something of the obsession of the collector in it. So I find 1843 is a magazine that has lots of tangential connections to the world and things I'm interested in, which is great.
And I think, Jenny, another thing that's interesting about that is there's a change of pace, even from The Economist's better-known output, of course. How important is that? And maybe we can reflect a little bit about a potential new arm to sort of art newspaper approach in terms of a magazine format that, again, the chronology is different from the newspaper. That is important, isn't it, for brands to be aware that there's a varied pace of consumption from their readers, from the interest groups that you've described. And it's important to try and meet them with new offerings and a change of pace editorially as well. Maybe you could reflect on the potential new product and tell how that fits in.
Absolutely. So we're trialling a magazine to go in our October edition. The first one is going to be themed. It's going to be around sculpture. I mean, sculpture is very interesting anyway, because at the moment it seems to be crossing over into performance and digital. So it's not just the kind of, you know, the object on the table or the big object in, you know, in the landscape. I think for us, it's an opportunity to do two things, really. I mean, one is this issue of images. I mean, as I said to you, one of the magazines I brought in is called Terp's Banana. And it's been created by an artist about 10 years ago called Marcus Harvey. And it focuses on painting, which it acknowledges is very unfashionable. I shouldn't like it because one of their missions is not to use professional art writers and critics. But actually, what I really like about it is because it's largely written by artists, but it has to be said, artists who can write, they are very good at thinking about, I suppose, the things that artists are interested in. So they're talking to artists in their studios and they're talking a lot about process and ideas in a way that I think is very engaging. But they also really choose images, and you can see it's chosen with the eyes of somebody who is really, really, really interested in the artwork itself. So for us, this magazine is a chance, I think, to do that too. You know, I think it's really, really useful for readers to see the artworks that you're talking about in your pieces. I know you can go and look them up online, but it's just much nicer and much easier to see them all in the same place. So I think that was one thing for us. We feel quite frustrated, I think, sometimes with our articles, that we would love to have more space, not to have masses of more words, but to have a lot more images. And also, I think that this will probably be a little bit more, assuming less knowledge, let's say. So we're hoping that it will appeal to art students, to regular exhibition goers, those kind of people, as well as our core audience.
Jane, it's fascinating to hear about that project. And that's in the October issue, you said?
Yes.
When we can look forward to that. You'll have to come back. and bring it with
us. That
bring
would
it
be
with
great.
You
Thank
and show you. Us the early proofs, perhaps. But it's a delight to share some of your art world reads. Thanks very much for coming to tell us all about them on the Stack.
Thank you for having me.
Finally, on today's programme, we turn our attentions to a new title set up by Birmingham-based journalist Connor Rees. It's called 99% Lifestyle, and it focuses on profiling interesting people from the creative industries with the aim of inspiring its readers, well, to get a bit more creative themselves. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Connor a little earlier.
Connor, a pleasure to have you here on the show to talk about your magazine, 99% Lifestyle. I have the beautiful cover of Volume 2 here in my hands. And before we talk about the second issue, tell us about the magazine. Why did you decide to have your own magazine?
Well, it started back when I was actually at university. I was studying journalism, and I was really interested in the magazine module on the course. And it all started with, I think it was in my second year, that module, because they gave you the task of creating your own magazine in a group. And that really made me realise that magazine work was something I wanted to do. So when it came to my final year of university and the second phase of the magazine module, you was tasked to create a magazine all by yourself. So I created that magazine, which was called 99% Lifestyle, which just looked at topics I was interested in, basically. So photography, design, filmmaking, everything like that, really. It was just a university project, that's all it was. And as soon as I left university, I submitted the magazine to a student awards, which was called the Midlands Media Awards. And the magazine ended up winning me the overall Student of the Year award for 2016. And it was judged by Peter Lowe, who was the editor of Sky News. And some of his comments that come back was quite eye-opening and positive. It made me realise that, wow, this is actually something people like, and perhaps I should pursue this and see whether I can turn this into something that I could get out into different retail outlets. From that point, I set about creating a magazine from scratch. I was able to get the funding through the Prince's Trust, and I created the first volume of 99% Lifestyle, which I launched back in November. And since then, basically, the 6 months have passed, and I've just released volume 2 of the magazine, which I was able to refine a bit more, add some finishes to the cover, make it a bit more compact, hone the focus a bit more as well, because the feedback I did receive from the first one that it was quite a broad range of topics. When the second volume came out, I was quite pleased with, and I felt this was the product that I always sort of wanted to create. So it was more of the complete package that focused on creativity, was aiming at inspiring people to become more creative and perhaps live life more to the full and travel more, maybe perhaps start their own business, just things like that, really.
Well, and it's interesting, you have your very own example to start your own magazine, you know, by yourself, and you were talking about distribution and everything. I did spot your magazine in some of the best news agents here in London. Do you have any future plans when it comes to, for example, advertising, distribution? What's the strategy? I mean, do you think perhaps getting someone else to help you with the magazine for the future?
I definitely think outsourcing is necessary to grow the brand, because at the moment everything is just done by myself, and I currently use the distributor at MMS, so they help with all the retail locations. But everything else, the website, social media, gathering the content, contacting advertisers, it's all done by myself, and it is a very, very time consuming to manage all these tasks. And as the title is quite small at the moment, there is only a print run of 1,000 copies, I'm able to sort of manage this quite well at the moment. But if I want the magazine to grow, which I do want to in the future, because I've heard feedback from some of the creatives that I've interviewed in, say, America, that there are quite a lot of shops that they could see this in. And I have been selling copies through the website to the US as well, that I would like to reach retail outlets in there. And to do that, it's going to require growing the magazine beyond that 1,000 print copy point to get an international distributor on board.
And your magazine feels very international. For example, there's a great story here with California-based designer Jacob Bogosian from the series Stranger Things. You know, that totally can work in America in some ways.
Yeah. I'm trying to incorporate different people from all around the world as much as I can, because I believe that despite different creatives having different outlooks and producing different pieces of work, I believe that different cultures also influence this. So I think it's quite important to show people that are coming from different places around the world to show what their outlook is and the creative pieces of work that they are creating.
Can people subscribe to the magazine yet, or how, what's your opinion like on subscriptions?
Subscriptions is definitely something that I am actually in the process of setting up at the moment, and I'm hoping that the subscription feature will be added to my website in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And I do think this is something that I'm going to have to put in place in order to help the sustainability of the title. The issue with me not putting it there for the first volume was because when I released volume one, I didn't want to add a subscription feature to the website where it gave me a deadline to reach the next title, knowing full well in advance that because no one really knew about this title and people didn't know it exists, basically, that it was going to be hard to financially be able to print the second issue within a set period of time, say 4 months. And now the title is becoming more and more known and it's reaching these different retail outlets and it's getting more press, more attention, the social media accounts are growing. I'm now in a position where I can sort of say that, yes, the next magazine will be out in a set time, so it's going to be out within the next 4 months, really. So to begin with, it wasn't really ideal, but now I'm in a position where I'm going to be adding that in the next few weeks. It's definitely important.
Well, you've been through the issue 2 test as well, because, you know, we do see some magazines, you know, they have a big launch and then, you know, the second issue sometimes is not as good, or there's no second issue sometimes, you know. So I think you've been through that. So I think issue 3 should be fairly straightforward in some ways. What do you think about that?
When I launched the first volume, I was saying to myself that it's great to be able to get this tangible product in my hand, and this is something that I've put blood, sweat and tears into and been able to create. But as soon as you put that first magazine out there, or any magazine, as soon as it's completed, you don't really have much time to sort of reflect on what you've done, because then the work starts for the next issue, because, as you say, that it's always about getting to the next magazine, basically. So as soon as Volume 1 was out, I started working on Volume 2 and tried to make it more of a complete product than Volume 1, because it was a massive learning curve. I'd learned a lot and I was able to learn so much from the mistakes that I'd made and the feedback I was receiving from various people in the industry, especially like I mentioned earlier about refining, say, the focus of the magazine. And I believe that I was able to do that for Volume 2. And even with Volume 2 now coming out, I've still learned a lot more about that publication, and there'll be slight changes made to the next issue as well. With each issue, you've got to look at it. It's a massive learning curve, and you're learning constantly about different aspects of not just print, but also business as well.
That was Connor Rees, editor and founder of 99% Lifestyle, in conversation with our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to Fernando and to Henry Rees Sheridan and to our editors Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome as always. Drop a note to Fernando. You'll find him at fp@monocle.com. And you can always catch up via iTunes or your preferred platform if you'll miss us before joining us at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.